This is CliffCentral.com.
All right. That's something happy. All we want is no doubt about it. Somebody take the music and turn it all the way up. If you came in a party, it's the Empire Cast with Jesse. Good morning. It is Thursday morning. Everybody's in a good mood. Well, I hope you are. If you're not, then maybe the next guest will help put you in a good mood. There are a lot of things about South Africa that we can moan and complain about every day. But there are a couple of things that we could be very proud of. And one of those is the jewel, really, of anybody in the world of safari, as the Americans like to say. And South Africans who like to go to the bush. It's the Kruger National Park. A huge tract of mostly unspoiled land, which was conserved very early on. It takes a huge amount of vision for someone 100 years ago, when really nature and the wild was this sustainable resource that would go on forever. There was always some unexplored place. Animals would always thrive somewhere. Some trees would just keep growing no matter what, and they'd keep spreading, and then there wouldn't be any problems. Humans would never get in the way because there were just not enough humans, and it wasn't a problem. So someone decided at some point in our history, we actually need to look after a big piece of land and keep it in pristine condition, as near as pristine as possible. And the Kruger National Park was born. Most of us take it for granted. I don't think we think about it too much. You go, oh, well, yeah, you can go out there if you want to. Some people think it's expensive. Some people think it's accessible. Who knows? Then land claims come along, complicates things a little bit. But ultimately, this is one of the best things about South Africa, whether you like it or not, and whether you're a big fan of the outdoors, or whether you're a massive fan of the animals, whether you're an ornithologist or a person who's particularly interested in the vegetation, who knows? It's really a haven for all of that stuff, though, and it seems almost, in a world where we're starting to take our place in the ecosystem a little more seriously, and we're starting to notice that we affect climate and things like that, maybe it's the time and place for us to actually consider that this small sacrifice of 100 years ago is going to turn into a massive boon. And maybe in some ways it already has. Enough about the philosophy around this. We're going to talk to a man who's spent a lot of time thinking about and talking about and working on stories around the Kruger National Park. Fascinating stories, moving stories, inspiring stories, and terrifying stories. Fair Game is what it's called, and he's sitting opposite me now. David Fleminger, how are you, sir?
Hi, Gareth. Nice to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, nice to meet you. First of all, there are actually a few people who've written stories about the Kruger National Park before. Did you love it so much you wanted to add things that were left out? Did you feel you could do a better job of this? Is it an area that you felt wasn't necessarily well enough represented in literature?
Okay, so first off, full confession.
Yeah.
Cards on the table.
Yeah.
The Kruger and the bush is not my favorite part of South Africa.
Oh.
I'm a mountain person.
Oh.
I like the Drakensberg.
Very controversial.
Very controversial. Cat amongst the pigeons. However, I was actually asked by my publisher about 10 years ago to write a travel guide on the Kruger.
Okay.
And when I started researching it, I found the history of the Kruger fascinating, and I found the travel guide part of it quite boring, because there are dozens of books about where to stay and which roads have a lion on them and how to spot game. And
were games, they were guides.
They're guides. They're okay. Tree spotting guides or game spotting guides, or Skakuza has these facilities, and I found that very boring. So I submitted a book that was 75% history and 25% travel. They didn't want it. They said they didn't think it was commercial. So years intervened, life got in the way, I did a whole bunch of other stuff, and I kept coming back.
But you'd already written
it. I'd written it. Yeah. The book was done. So yeah. I was on my computer, and I decided, you know what? This is a good story. It's only been told as a history once or twice by academic historians, who are fantastic, and they do the hard work.
Yeah.
They do the grunt work. They really go through the documents and find that story. But it becomes quite hard to access, because the language is very academic and the theories behind it are very academic. So I thought this would make a great popular history. So I approached it from that point of view, and there is no popular history on the Kruger Park.
Hmm.
you'll often get a little couple of pages at the beginning of a guidebook or on a website that sketches the very broad strokes, often incorrectly. But I thought that this was a good story worth telling in an accessible, fun way.
Look, we all know it's a beautiful part of the country. A lot of us know Jocko the Bushveld. Mm-hmm. A lot of us know, you know, that this is a sanctuary for a lot of very rare and endangered species, and a lot of the things that we identify as being things that we're proud of as South Africans, as Africans.
Sure.
We use the animals in our we depict them in money. And in all kinds of places.
Well, the Kruger is actually part of our national identity. When you think about it, it's part of what makes us South African. Let's say safari. Everybody wants to come and go on safari. And I often say, you know, with South Africans, if they say, I'm going to a game reserve, you'll say, oh, which one? If they say, I'm going to the game reserve, you know they're talking about Kruger. Because it is the game reserve in South Africa. So it's important as a tourism attraction, as important as our part of our national identity, really can't be overstated. It's a massive part of who we are, I think.
So, first of all, why is it called the Kruger National Park?
Okay, so this is a big spoiler I'm about to give away, which is like the big twist in the book. Paul Kruger had very little to do with it. He was not a fan of conservation. He was a hunter. Mm. And just before the second Anglo-Boer War broke out, there was a big problem in the Transvaal. The game stock was being hunted out. The wild animals, the farmers were hunting it out. They were using it for leather, food, rimpies, whatever they were using it for. But the wild animals were disappearing. And they complained to Kruger. However, Kruger knew that by banning hunting or restricting hunting, he risks alienating the population of his electorate, which are rural. So he stalled. And eventually, after nagging by a couple of members of the Volksraad back then, the Kruger's government eventually passed a bill declaring the Sabi as a national park. The Sabi as a game reservoir. Sorry, let me correct myself. Mm-hmm. The Sabi reserve was from the Sabi River by Skukuza down to Crocodile. Okay. Just the bottom southern part.
It's not a big place.
And the idea there was to stop hunting in that reserve for long enough so that the game stock could recover. And then it would be reopened for hunting. And that was the idea behind the reserve. So the reserve is declared. Anglo-Boer War breaks out. The reserve is essentially abandoned. After the Anglo-Boer War, the Brits are now caretakers, so to speak. And they appoint James Stevenson Hamilton, a Scotsman, who was in his early 50s by then already. And he was the one who fought for years and years and years to get the park declared a national park. As in, it would not be reopened for hunting. It would be a sanctuary as opposed to a reservoir. And he fought a lot. Nobody wanted to do it. There was no support.
What kind of a guy is this?
He's an interesting guy. He described himself as an unusual chap. He was very short, about 5'2", 5'3". He was born to a semi-aristocratic family in Scotland. There was a family manor. There was a estate that he inherited.
Yeah, the Hamiltons are quite well represented in the Scottish aristocracy.
Well, he actually had to take... He was James Stevenson, and he had to take on the Hamilton in order to get the inheritance. To that effect. That's why he's got such a long name. Okay. So he was a bit of a London playboy, as was the trend in those days. He had to get a commission in the army because that's what, you know, the aristocracy weren't good for anything else. So they had to go in the army, and he hated it. He hated taking orders. He hated drilling practice. He hated what he thought was wasting his time on parade grounds in England. He just didn't like it. He was more of an individualistic kind of guy. So he volunteered for a couple of expeditions to South Africa. His regiment was sent out for a short little war, not one of our big ones, one of our smaller ones. And he liked it here. And then when the Anglo-Boer War came out, he came over and he was approached and he decided to stay. There was nothing in his history to suggest anything about animals, game, wildlife, conservation. There was no background there. I think he was the kind of guy who was up for an adventure, is the sense I get from him. And he went to the park, and he very quickly started learning about it. He taught himself, he read widely, and he came to see the park as, he called it, his Cinderella. And it became his mission to keep his Cinderella safe. And there were a lot of people who didn't want the park. as you said, conservation wasn't a concept 100 years ago.
No, people just shot whatever they wanted to shoot.
Exactly. There was a theory at the time that it was the black villagers, the native inhabitants who were hunting out the game. But that was nonsense because they'd been living with the game for generations sustainably. They they used what they needed and there was a synergy there.
Right.
It was the white hunters and the white farmers who eradicated the game. So he had to fight off farmers. He had to fight off mining people who wanted to go inspecting. He had to fight off... later the railways came in and development and human settlements and nobody wanted the park. It was basically him against the world.
Well, it's a huge tract of land. I mean, you know, a lot of people say, well, it could have been even bigger. But the fact is...
It actually should have been bigger. It's the wrong shape.
Tell me why?
The park's very narrow and it runs north to south.
Right.
But the elephant migration patterns are east-west. From the foot of the Drakensberg Mountains by God's Window there, to the Lubombo Mountains. That's the natural migration pattern. But because of various politics, the park eventually became a long corridor north to south where it should have been east to west. And they are trying to fix that by joining together various conservation areas to recreate that east-west migration route. It's going to be tricky, but yes, the reserve we wound up with is actually the wrong shape. But we're lucky to have had it at all. You actually asked me a question which I never answered.
Yeah. So they said at the time it was too small, it was the wrong size or whatever. The fact is, that was millions of hectares of land that could have been turned into farms, as you say, mines, human habitation. Mm-hmm. This is good land. It's fertile.
Well, it is good land, but there's one big drawback, and that's it's in a fever belt. The malaria... Nagana, spread by the tsetse fly. There are a bunch of indigenous diseases in the Kruger, in the Lowveld, which actually kept human habitation quite low, at least 100 years ago before medicines were developed to better control those kinds of things.
Right.
So the fever belt, the malaria, is actually one of the things that kept the Kruger relatively safe. Nevertheless, you actually asked me, how did the Kruger get its name?
Yeah.
Which I was working up to. So, Stevenson Hamilton's in charge. Nobody wants to know anything about it. Kruger's long dead. It's 1926 or so. The new government has just come in to replace Jan Smuts, who was a very big conservationist. Jan Smuts was a visionary as well. He was the guy who came up with the concept of holism, as in everything's interconnected. And he was a big conservationist, and Stevenson Hamilton was making headway to declare national park. However, Smuts lost the election, and a rising Afrikaner nationalist government
came in. That
was
Malan and Voigt and those guys.
It's not quite. It's a little bit before the 1948 Nats.
For Botha?
It was after Botha. Botha died about 1910.
Oh, so then we're talking
It was, what was the name of the guy? It was Herzog. It was J.B. Herzog. Herzog came in and brought in a whole new Afrikaner, the emerging Afrikaner identity. And Stevenson Hamilton was sitting with a friend of his, an artist, Stratford Caldecott, and they were trying to work out, okay, what are we going to do now? We've got a whole new set of bosses to talk to. We've got to start from scratch again. And they realized that Piet Grobler, the Minister of Lands, was Paul Kruger's grand-nephew. And they said, you know what? What if we name the national park, the proposed national park, after Paul Kruger? And they said, brilliant. They called it the Kruger Stunt. And they went to Piet Grobler. They pitched this idea about the Kruger National Park. Piet Grobler suddenly loved the idea that his great uncle is now going to get memorialized.
Jesus, you can always get a lot done with ego, huh?
I tell you, a bit of spin, a bit of ego, know who to play. And
if they declared the whole of the Western United States Trump National Park, they'd have all the conservation areas they'd ever need.
Yeah, they would. They'd be drilling everywhere, but they'd have the space. And in a blink, all opposition melted away. He writes in his diary. He was a very witty man, very dry but witty. And he wrote in his diary, between me and this page, it is myself who has really fought for the Kruger Park. Let them think it. Let them think it was Paul Kruger. I don't care. The result is what I want.
So what was his vision to create what we've got now?
his vision was to protect the animals. Because remember, his job when he was given it in 1902 was to stop hunting for a period so the game stock could recover, so that the hunting could be, the area could be reopened for hunting. So he got the Sabi Reserve, which is Crocodile River up to Sabi River. He realized it was too small immediately, within a year. He spent a lot of time traveling around and discovering things, and he saw it was too small to allow the ecosystem to recover. So they declared the Shingwetsi Reserve up in the north, and the middle part of the park, Olifants area, that was all private farmland. It was uninhabited. It was land speculators. Basically, they went and bought the land dirt cheap and sat in it waiting for something to happen. Might sound familiar with our current discussions about land expropriation and that kind of stuff. But they were sitting on this empty land, hoping one day it would be worth something. He approached the land companies that owned the land, and he said, listen, let me use this land and manage it for 5 years. And they agreed. Mm-hmm. So he then had this much bigger area to look after, which he did. He put rangers in charge. Each of these, the first, they call them the first guard, they all had ranger stations at Pretorius Kop, at Satara, at Shingwetsi, which all the ranger stations became rest camps, basically. And he renewed that a couple of times, that agreement with the landholders. And then in 26, or just before that, the landowners said, no, we want this land, we're going to start developing it. And that is what prompted this drive to get it declared a national park. And Piet Grobler, once he had the great idea to name it after Kruger, went to the landowners and basically forced them to exchange land inside the park for land outside the park. Hmm. Some of those farms became Sabi Sabi, Mala Mala, all those private reserves in that area. That was all land that was swapped out. And some of that land was also given to human settlements, Acorn Hook, Bushbuck Ridge, all those very densely populated areas just on the outside of the reserve were all essentially part of that land exchange for the central section.
Jeez. You know, you think about it now, animals don't pay tax, they don't have a constituency value, politicians don't really give a shit about animals, and in those days they gave less of a care for it. It must have been very unpopular, not just with the strident Afrikaner politics of the time, but it must have also been unpopular with the indigenous people. Very unpopular with, you know, black people who lived in the area who'd hunted for a living, who now are told that they can't hunt anymore, they can't grow their vegetables here, they can't live here.
Mm-hmm. There wasn't a large population in the park, but there was certainly a good few thousand villagers living in the yeah. Kruger, and he had to remove them. In fact, the nickname Skakuza, he was given the nickname Skakuza, means he who sweeps away or he who scrapes clean, because he had to, not only did he have to get white rangers to go and start patrolling and stop poaching and telling farmers not to come and hunt there, he had to recruit black rangers from the villages inside the park and get them to move their own people out.
Jeez.
So it was a problematic issue.
So difficult to do, but ultimately very much worth it, because we've got this jewel now.
Correct. Sometimes
short-term pain, long-term gain.
Something like that. What is quite remarkable is, as he wrote in his diaries, once people started appreciating the animals, he said, it is beyond heartening to realize that the South African public, despite tradition, is happy to look at animals rather than shoot them. Hmm. Because we were not a conservation-minded country. We did not have this ethos of protecting the environment or looking after game, which is, I think, very much part of us today. I think we are very environmentally...
Well, look at how people get upset about the rhino horns.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, people are pissed off about that stuff. We didn't care before.
Well, no. Our ancestors
were hunters.
It was a resource to be exploited.
All right, so... In your book, you cover a lot of stories. There's a whole chapter you put together about the hunting and about what was fair game and what wasn't. They used to be able to hunt in the Kruger Park.
Before it was declared a national park, some farmers approached the government and said, listen, we want to be allowed in for winter grazing and for winter hunting. And they did. They got permission. So the grazers were allowed to go in. And, of course, you're allowed to protect your sheep or your cattle. So there was hunting going on.
From predators. So they would shoot.
Well, that's another interesting thing. Is, you know, today, Big Five, you know, the only question in the Kruger is, where's the lion? Where's the leopard? Where are the predators? That's all we want to see. They were not the star of the early Kruger Park.
No, it was antelope.
It was antelope, because that's what the hunters wanted, because they wanted an antelope head on their wall of their manor
trophy,
house with big horns.
There was someone who, in your footnotes, you say, they came back from some expedition, I think, to Delagoa Bay, with many trophies, one of them being malaria.
Yeah.
Is that right?
They did. That was Louis Trichardt.
Yeah, you mentioned malaria. We'll get to that in a second.
Yeah,
okay. But carry on with the hunting.
Yeah, so...
Antelope with the stars.
Antelope with the stars. Predators were vermin, mm-hmm. were seen as vermin, and for the first 20-odd years, up until it was declared a national park, essentially, predators were culled as a matter of policy, because his job...
All of them.
Wild dog, cheetah, leopard, lion. They were culled actively because his mandate was to protect the antelope. So he had to kill the predators to allow the antelope the space to recover without being hunted. And it was only tourists who started coming to the park after it was declared a national park who loved the lions, and suddenly people realized, oh, hang on a second, this isn't a great policy, and they stopped the culling.
It's just such a 180-degree turn from these are vermin that must be exterminated mm-hmm. to these are the most precious of our animals.
Yeah. Well, I mean, also, you know, the Big Five is a hunting term.
Sure.
The most dangerous animals to hunt. So the hunting culture, I'll do a slight digression here. You mentioned Jock of the Bushveld earlier. Have you ever read Jock of the Bushveld?
Yeah.
I hadn't.
Oh,
I only read
okay.
it when I was researching this book. What a vile, violent, racist, revolting kid's book. I was appalled by it. So I actually have a big controversy. I have a section where I rant about how much I dislike Jock of the Bushveld and how much I don't agree with what it stands for at all.
But then he was a guy of that time as well.
He was. But so was Stevenson Hamilton. And while Stevenson Hamilton certainly wasn't what we would consider enlightened or liberal, he was a lot further down the road than people like Fitzpatrick and those guys. It's an awful book. I mean, it is so racist. The natives are dismissed as being lazy and shiftless and useless.
It's
a terrible book.
Okay, so let's just quickly go back to the animals for a second. So the Big Five, that term as a hunting term, has now become a term for people who want to spot the animals.
Yeah. In fact, I think it's become a bit all-encompassing. I mean, people are obsessed with the Big Five.
Yeah, they talk about it in terms of currency and in terms of everything else.
It's what you want to see. You know, if you are a rich tourist from overseas and you're paying thousands of dollars a night.
There's a Big Five birds, there's a Big Five trees, there's a Big Five...
Insects.
I mean, you can go as small or as big as you want here.
It's a brilliant marketing idea. I think it's become a little bit of an obsession. You know, if you go to one of these timber varieties, one of these very expensive reserves, and you don't see the Big Five...
You feel like you've been shortchanged.
They'll complain.
So, Sia, do you know... Have you seen all Big Five of the Big Five insects?
The Big Five insects? No, I have not. I don't even know who they are.
You haven't?
I'm so ill-informed.
Who are the Big Five birds? Do you know offhand?
Can I refer to my book?
Sure.
Because I don't remember offhand.
You must have the Marshall Eagle in there. What kinds of animals are we talking about? You got the Big Five birds, Big Five insects,
mammals. Okay, so the Big Five insects I know is, they're all, there's a little five.
Oh, is that your phone?
That's my phone. It's my alarm. Gareth, this is very early in the morning for me. I've got to
tell
you.
What are you usually doing this time of the day? It's a terrible alarm.
I'm normally
fast asleep.
That'll
never wake you up.
Well, that's partly the plan.
That will never wake you up.
That's an awful alarm. That's awful.
Okay, give us the top five birds.
The top five birds, I'm still looking for them.
By the way, there is an element to your book which is kind of like a guide, and
yes.
I like that.
Because
at the back there's all sorts of practical information. You know, what's where someone's grave is in the middle of the felt somewhere.
Yes.
You've got this little... You wonder why this place is named after this person, why that's named after this one. It's all very interesting. You must have done years of research.
I like research. I like putting the story together. You know, for me, history is not about the when, it's mm-hmm. about the why. Okay. It explains why things are the way they are. If you have a question about how we are today, the way we are, look back. You'll find the answers. You'll find the connections that led us here.
History's so rewarding. Like, you always feel like you're uncovering truths.
Absolutely. Well, it's about giving you a better perspective.
Yeah.
Because you're not just looking at it at the moment.
Right.
You're looking at how you got to this moment. And for me, that's crucial. So this whole history thing about compulsory in schools, I actually support it as long as it is done in an impartial, productive way.
It mustn't be political history.
It's very easy to make history political. I mean, history is written by the winners. Here we go. I found the list.
Okay.
So the birding big six.
Big six.
Big six. Oh. Yeah, birds get six. Ground hornbill.
That's the one with the big red beak.
That's the one with the big red beak. Corrie bustard.
That's a boring.
I said bustard, not bastard.
What a boring bird. They think that's a big one? Okay.
Listen, another confession.
The color of felt.
I can barely tell the difference between an albatross and an ostrich. That's about as far as my bird knowledge goes. Yeah, okay, leopard-faced vulture.
Yeah, that's the big carrion-eating. It's got a pink face. It's got the largest wingspan of any vulture.
Hmm. Yeah. I didn't know you were a twitcher, Gareth. A little bit. Okay.
A little bit.
Marshall eagle.
Yes, said that already. That's the biggest of the eagles.
Pell's fishing owl.
Brown head and white speckled front. I'm impressed. Also, very big wingspan. You could pick it out from the others because of that, the head and the flight pattern. Okay. All right.
Pell's fishing owl.
Very rare owl. Big owl. Orangey in color. Usually found, as in the name would suggest, near water.
Right.
And I think they may even be, they're the second biggest owl of all.
Oh, okay.
Only found in this part of Africa, really.
And the saddlebill stork.
Okay. Quite an ugly bird. No. Saddlebill's the one with the black and yellow and red on its beak. It's very colorful, in fact. I'm thinking of the shoebill.
The shoebill.
Shoebill's very ugly.
So
look that up. If you want to see what your mother-in-law will look like when she's 85, look up a shoebill.
So we also have the little five.
And what are the little five?
The little five, they basically took the big five and found an equivalent smaller species. So you have the buffalo weaver. You have the elephant shrew. You have the leopard tortoise.
Yeah.
The ant lion.
Yeah.
And the rhino beetle.
Oh, who cares? Jesus. Yeah. To me, the most exciting thing of all is a kill.
Yes. I got to tell you, I have never seen a real kill. I've seen...
Happen in action.
Yeah. I've seen a leopard waiting on the side of the road, stalking a buck, and waiting and waiting and waiting, and then dashing off into the bush after it. But I haven't actually seen an actual kill.
All right, I want to talk about some of the stories in here. What are your favorite stories from the Kruger Park? Just give us a taste of it so that people who you've got to go and buy the book, for heaven's sake, and we'll tell you how to do that because you've published this yourself.
I did.
Right, which I think is a whole other story.
That is a whole other story.
Give us a taste to make us excited and hungry for more.
There are so many stories in the Kruger. Every ranger, especially the early ones, wrote their own memoirs. There's the famous story of Harry Volitor and the lion, who he was stalked by two lions by himself. He was alone. He got wounded. He had to drag himself. His horse got chased away by a lion. The lion ran after the horse. He had been bitten. So he dragged himself to a tree. A second lion came out of the bush and started stalking him.
Jesus.
The lion got him by his shoulder, dragging him. He was being dragged backwards on his back, facing the lion. The lion's mouth was right in front of his face. He reached into his sock and got out his little his little bush knife, stabbed the lion a couple of times, ran to a tree that was nearby, climbed up the tree, and he was going to pass out because he was bleeding. So he strapped himself with his belt to a tree, the lion pacing around the bottom of the tree the whole night.
Oh, my God.
And in the morning, his people found him. His crew found him and took him back. And he survived those injuries, gangrene and infection and all that kind of stuff, and he survived. And that tree, what I like about the Kruger is they got plaques everywhere. You know, you can do the game stuff, or you can do the history stuff, and there's lots of history all over the Kruger. the tree is still there. It's died a long time ago. So they've taken the bare stump, really, and put in a concrete plinth with a plaque saying, this is the tree that Harry Volater climbed, and it's just a little wooden stick. So that's a very famous story of Harry Volater and the lion. I actually also like one of the stories I like. It's not inside the Kruger, but it is part of the Kruger. And it goes back to the Voortrekkers, our old friends, the Voortrekkers, who there's no need to lionize them as we once did. And, you know, they need,
I mean, these were explorers, but they were tough people.
They were tough people, yeah, and they were determined. What I like is there's a story about Hendrik Potgieter and his party.
Right.
They were all camped on the side of a river. Potgieter was trying to get down the mountains to find a route to Lorenzo Marx through the fever belt. That was the big barrier to get to Lorenzo Marx.
Because so many of them died of malaria.
They did.
So
many. Yeah. Trichardt, as you said, managed to get to Lorenzo Marx, whereupon his entire party died of malaria. So...
Worth it!
So they were camping on the side of the river. Potgieter and a group of his top men went for a recce, went down the hill. They disappeared. Weeks went by. The party grew very despairing. And because the Voortrekkers were a very literal bunch of people, they named the river they were camping alongside the Trier River, the River of Sorrow, River of Mourning. They packed up. They camped. They moved on a few days or whatever. They camped at another river. Lo and behold, Potgieter and his men arrive. Out of the blue, they call that the Blader River, the River of Joy.
Blader River Canyon. Got you.
Right. And the confluence where the River of Sorrow meets the River of Joy is the Birkslack potholes.
Oh, wow.
So there's this amazing natural geological formation. Anybody who's been to the Lowveld or that panorama route anyway.
Yeah.
And I just like that the Joy and Sorrow meet and form potholes. There's something about that.
It's really a beautiful part of the country in so many ways. You've got those mountains. You've got that large, unspoiled tract of felt. You've got up in the north the Limpopo River. Down in the south, you've got the Sabi and the crocodile. And there's a lot of kind of lush forest in some places. There's rock. It shows so much of what South Africa must have been like 100, 200 years ago.
I think that's part of the appeal. Yeah.
People try to imagine. I often try to imagine what Johannesburg would have looked like 50 to 70 years ago.
So do I, actually. It's grasslands, which is the part that I always, you know, when you look at the trees, you know, none of those trees were indigenous. They were all planted here. So you just imagine, what did this look like? And you can go to Sacred Bosch Runt. Actually, gives me quite a good idea what the Highveld might have looked like. But Kruger has a vast number of biomes, and this has been analysed and broken down in minute detail. The north is lusher, more tropical, thicker trees, thicker forests, bigger rivers. The middle part is plains, so you've got those big open grassy plains with a few trees here and there. And the south is more thickets and grass alternating. You know, they sometimes describe the south as the circus, the middle section as the zoo, and the northern section as the wilderness.
Oh, really?
Because
it starts getting more
remote. I mean, if you go up far north to Crook's Corner and Pafuri region, and you get to things like the Fever Tree Forest, which is the most unreal, eerie, strange forest of these yellow, bright yellow fever trees. You drive through them. Phenomenal. There's also some ancient ruins there, Tulamela, dating about 2,000 years ago, Stonewall City, similar to Great Zimbabwe. That's near Punda Maria, which was uncovered about 30 years ago. Huh. You can go visit it. Remarkable to go and see. And it's a whole nother part of the history that came 2000 through.
2,000 years ago. That's fascinating.
Yeah, about 2,000 years ago. I'm sorry. I'm correcting myself. 800 years ago, not 2,000 years ago. Mapungubwe was more like that.
Let's just talk quickly about some of the villains. Because there have been a lot of really shitty people involved with the Kruger Park and involved in its stories and people who just history should be unkind to. And then there are people who were real heroes. I mean, outline for us some of those characters.
The big hero is Stevenson Hamilton.
Right.
Because quite... it's easy to say without him, we wouldn't have a Kruger Park. It would have been deproclaimed. It would have been chopped up and sold off and whatever.
Where did he die?
He died in White River at age 90.
Buried there?
As far as I know,
okay.
He's buried in White River. Yes, that's a good question. Mm. Actually, you've caught me out a bit there. Okay. I'm not sure where he's buried.
That's all right. You don't have to know everything.
What do you mean? I'm an expert.
Well, you kind of are, but I mean, you don't need to know everything about every person.
Right. I know he died at age 90, and he retired to a farm in White River.
Okay.
He's a big hero. The first god of rangers, Volata. Sure, there's so many. Kutsia, that whole first god of rangers are all heroes. They went into the middle of nowhere. Yeah, there was nothing.
And are there any animals that the populations were so different to what they are now in terms of massive numbers as opposed to minute numbers?
Just about everything. When he first went into the park, he writes in his diary that, you know, he saw a couple of impala, and he saw one or two waterbuck, and he said there was nothing to suggest that this was a great game sanctuary. There was nothing to suggest that this had the potential to become anything, because there were virtually no game. They were threadbare. Mm. And yet he decided he was going to make this happen, and he would protect what he saw as his animals.
So in other words, it wasn't this place that was teeming with wildlife that was shouting out, please make us a reserve.
No, it was quite the opposite. It was the last little dregs of the wildlife that was still there.
That hadn't been hunted out.
That hadn't been hunted out. I mean, if you think about it, the Cape, all the wild animals were hunted out. Mm. You know, we've got Bontebok National Park, which is like to protect a population of 25 Bontebok. Yeah, that's a mountain zebra national park in the Western Cape. You know, the original population was also about 25, 30 mountain zebra. So they hunted out the entire Cape. They hunted out the entire Free State. There are no game reserves in the Free State. Mm-hmm. The only place where there was still game in a more or less natural state was Hlahlwi Umfolozi, which actually predates Kruger, has its own story.
Northern KZN.
Northern KZN. And Kruger. And the big villains of the piece, it's actually quite hard to say. I would say it's faceless government bureaucracy is actually the big villain, because he kept going from one department to another. No, the game reserves, once they were declared as a thing, were shifted to Native Affairs had them for a while. Why? I don't know. And then it went to land, and then it went to various other departments, and he kept having to deal with these faceless bureaucrats who were only interested in getting votes, and they knew by banning hunting they risk alienating a thing, because politicians are nothing if not expedient.
When did the major sort of rest camps start to develop as the places that you would go to in Kruger?
So once it was declared a national park, one of those conditions of that, and the national park concept came from America. Mm-hmm. And that is saying that
it was Theodore Roosevelt.
Even a little bit before, he was a big champion of the national park system, but it started a little bit earlier than Roosevelt. The idea is that these spaces must be made available to the public for edification, education, entertainment, national pride. That was the concept. So he had to open the park, which he didn't want to do. He liked his park, you know, he liked being chief of his domain.
A private reserve.
He didn't really want to let people in. It wasn't a priority for him, but he had to. So gradually, each ranger station started building small little rondavels. In the very early days, they would stay in the ranger station. There's stories of the rangers waking up to find tourists in their bathroom brushing their teeth with the ranger's toothbrush and that kind of stuff. It was a free-for-all, basically. Guns were allowed. You could travel in with your gun in case you were charged by a buffalo. And there was like stories of big parties and music, and you know, it sounds quite wild, actually.
Jeez.
And then they had to build roads. They had to build infrastructure, all that kind of stuff.
And water and electricity.
Water, electricity, and that was an ongoing process that Stevenson Hamilton didn't really love.
Yeah.
He was not a huge fan, but it had to happen. And that accelerated over time.
One of the most recent developments here is the agreement with this Transfrontier Park with Mozambique.
Mm.
Has that been beneficial? Has that not just increased the land, but also the game and the opportunity, or has it made it much more difficult to manage?
I'm a big fan of Transfrontier Parks.
Okay.
I think in principle they're amazing initiatives. I'm a big fan of conservation in general. You know, the more area that is under conservation, somehow the happier I am. I can't really explain why, but I like the fact that there are areas that are protected.
And that animals can roam free. They don't care Correct. About our borders.
Yeah, no, well, that's another story.
It's arbitrary.
I'm very anti-border in general.
Yeah.
But I think that the big plan for the Greater Kruger area, they've incorporated a section of Mozambique.
Mm-hmm.
The big plan is to include Gonerezu on the other side of Limpopo in Zimbabwe and to extend the Mozambique side to a huge section of Mozambique. When that park is complete, it will be the right shape. It will it will be able to sustain...
And all these private parks on the western side that have put down their fences.
Put down their fences. So it's all about increasing the space for the animals. So I'm a big fan. I've never been to the Mozambique side. There are two amazing camps that look just phenomenal, which I'd like to get to. One's built right on the banks of the river. And it also gives the Mozambican side, the game on the Mozambican side, a chance to recover, because those animals were living with a civil war just as much as the humans were. So they were hunted for bushmeat. They were blown up by landmines. So I'm a big fan. I know that the relocation of the elephants hasn't gone that well because the elephants keep going back to their old stomping grounds. But with time, I think that the Transfrontier Park is going to become something quite remarkable, easily rivaling the Maasai or the Serengeti.
How big is the Kruger Park compared to other big parks in the world?
It's pretty big. It's about 2 million square kilometers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty big. I actually don't know
what it's comparable to.
I would have to do a little bit of research on that.
What's your favorite place in the Kruger National Park?
I do like Lower Sabi. I think that Lower Sabi, the setting, the dams, the sunset over the dams. There's something about Lower Sabi that speaks to me. And for remoteness, Crook's Corner is a fascinating little
place.
That's right up at the top.
The border of Zimbabwe, Mozambique, and South Africa.
Pretty much. It was a thoroughly disreputable place where thoroughly disreputable people went there to hide.
It was a major, but it was also an illicit trading port, basically, yes. Because the three countries would have all kinds of their dodgiest people talking to each other at that point in the river.
It was basically where you went when you didn't want to be found. And there's stories about...
That's why it's called Crook's Corner.
Crook's Corner, yeah. They kind of gave it away.
I've been there seven times. It is the
seven
most...
Seven times.
The most
Crook's
beautiful,
Corner, Al.
Beautiful place in
Alan
the whole...
Alan Ford, everybody. Here he is. He's here to talk about his show.
I'm obsessed with the bush.
Okay.
I've been seven times to Crook's Corner. It is magnificent. It's where the Luvuvu River meets the Limpopo.
I love
Pofuri up at go through the Pofuri Gate. People think it's impossible to get there. It's not at all, actually. And it is incredible. And this past winter, actually not this one, the one before, because it was so dry, you had seriously 300 or 400 elephants just around the corner.
Oh, wow.
That piece of the river, because the Limpopo was so dry,
yeah.
I saw close on about maybe 60 or 70 crocodiles and about 50 hippo. It's incredible. And the leopard that come in through there, listen to me, it's one of those gems. Go to Crook's Corner. Because I always say...
I see you excited about many things. This is exciting.
If you can go from the tip of Southern Africa, let's say it's Cape Agulhas, it's not Cape Point, but let's go Cape Point for the sake of it. You can go to the north of South Africa, which is Crook's Corner. That is the top and the bottom.
I absolutely agree.
It's really cool.
I absolutely agree.
Sorry to interrupt you,
please. What I like about Crook's Corner is that there was like one trading post that was run by two men in the middle of nowhere with just no goodniks and rotters all around them. And these two guys ran a trading post and they didn't speak to each other.
They
didn't get along. They hated each other.
Portuguese man. The one is the Portuguese Fernandes.
I can't remember their names. I just like this idea that, you know, these two people stranded in the middle of nowhere didn't
speak. Did you discover anything that they didn't even know they had? Like, was there some of your research that led you to certain places or certain stories that people in the Kruger had no idea was there before?
Well, it's interesting because I've given a talk based on the book to quite a few people. I've given a talk in the Lowveld, in Nelspruit, to people who work
there,
in the Kruger and live there and like really know the Kruger. And a lot of them said to me they knew bits of the story, but they'd never heard it put together from a modern contemporary perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Kruger narrative was hijacked. Like everything else during apartheid, they hijacked the narrative to suit themselves. They put up the bust of Paul Kruger. The Kruger Park became a counterpart of the Voortrekkers. You know, this is our destiny. This is our right, our birthright as the Afrikaner to own this land. And look how proud we are of our land. So that's why Stevenson Hamilton was diminished. Kruger was pushed up. Piet Grobler was pushed up. There's a lot of revision that needs to be done in our understanding of how the Kruger came to be. One of the stories that I like a lot that doesn't get a lot of comments is there was actually a camp for non-white residents.
Oh, how nice of them.
Very nice of them. Not black people, unfortunately, you know, obviously, you know, they wouldn't want to do there. But for non-whites, Indians, Asians, that kind of thing.
You got to love that apartheid government. They're so thoughtful.
Well, it was all about separate but equal. They said.
Yeah, I wonder how many black people got let into the Kruger Park to go and have a look.
Black people were allowed into the Kruger Park as part of the labor routes.
To work,
The labor routes carrying people from
Mozambique. The black diamonds.
Well, the black people who collected diamonds, yes.
So just tell me about this non-white
camp. So they never ran electricity to the camp.
Of course
they
not.
Never ran...
Separate but equal,
exactly. They never ran anything. It was a very small camp, very basic. You can, wherever you are, you can see the perimeter fence and you can see straight through it. It's a very small camp, no restaurant, no swimming pool, nothing.
But that sounds now.
Now, nice. It's the most popular camp in the park. You have to book years in advance to get a chalet in Balule because it is so quiet and so peaceful and so integrated into the environment. And I just like the way history changes, perceptions change, realities change, and I quite like that part of the. I quite like that kind of reinvention of the park.
Well, thank you. I mean, this is a terrific book. It's called Fair Game. Now, David, because you self-published, where can we get it?
It is available at Exclusive Books. I hope so.
Good.
If it is not, please ask them to order it. Alternatively, you can go to my website. I am selling them online as well. That's www.davidfleminger.com.
Gotcha.
With one M, Fleming with Fleminger with one M. It's also available in the park itself at the Kruger Park shops. I managed to get it those parks.
That was a big one.
Hopefully more as we go along. I'm learning as I go.
Oh, terrific work. It's called Fair Game, A Hidden History of the Kruger National Park. David Fleminger, thanks for coming to speak to us.
Thanks so much, Gareth.
Yeah, what a pleasure.
This is CliffCentral.com.